Welcome, welcome, welcome back from the holidays. It's good to see you or hear you again. Welcome to What'd You Think, the movie review show, which is the drive home from the movie after you've enjoyed the movie that is filled with fantastic and wonderful spoilers. This time over the holidays, we saw Secret Life of Walter Mitty, which personally I really enjoyed. And today, as always, we have with us the lovely Bobby Blakey. And joining us also as our special guest, the lovely Andrew Farmer.
Help, I'm trapped in a cardigan. I'm trapped in a cardigan, help. That's my Nick Cage impression.
Nice.
Yeah.
You give him a cardigan for sweater for Christmas and this is what happens.
That's right. I can't find motor skills.
Technically anybody wearing a cardigan is trapped in it.
Well played, Bobby. Well played.
Well, Andrew, since you are company, why don't you get us started with The Secret Life of Walter Mitty? How do you think it compared to the trailers that you saw, what you were expecting to see?
You know, I went and saw the trailer. I forget what movie. I saw it before. It was something earlier this year. And I really was interested after seeing the trailer. I was like, I'm going to see this movie. I think it was At World's End. Was the movie where I saw the trailer for the first time, now that I think about it.
Okay.
I was really interested in seeing it, and I went in with the expectation based on what that first trailer was, and I wasn't let down. It was one of those rare occasions where, you know, I've talked at length with other people about how you get three different types of trailers. You get the action trailer, the comedy trailer, and the drama trailer. For
right.
Every movie that comes out, where they just pull those little snippets out and show them to you, like, oh, it's going to be a comedy, and then it's not. Or, oh, it's going to be an action movie, and it's not. This one, the trailer really hit it on the head as far as what you could expect from the movie, at least for me.
Oh, cool. Cool. Bobby, what do you think?
I was kind of like him where but in kind of an opposite way, like, I really, really enjoyed the film, but the trailers, to me, were a little misleading from a standpoint of they only focused on the fantastical, imaginative world that he deals with.
Okay.
And that's such a small part of that film that luckily I went into it and said, you know what, I'm just going to have an open mind. I'm going all in because it just looks like it has the potential to be a great movie. And I wasn't let down. I loved it, and I love that it wasn't just that fantastical world. But I think that's going to be where some of the people that may not enjoy it as much are going to have some issues because they're going to go in expecting a lot of those wacky, crazy moments that you see in the trailers, and you only get a small handful.
Yeah, I agree. There was a lot fewer than I expected, too. I appreciated the fact that when I went into the movie, that the whole concept was going to be, okay, he lives in the fantasy world, but then his world gets turned upside down, and then he starts living in this world and be a lot more exciting and all that. But, man, they didn't make that switch really early in the game.
Mm-hmm.
Well, to me, it wasn't so much of a switch. Like, I loved the way they handled it. And what I really kind of expected from the film was I thought it was going to be the fantasy stuff, and then the fantasy was going to be the whole film, different scenarios, and then they were going to be teaching him lessons, and then he was going to kind of find himself through these fantastical journeys. But I love that it actually took him on a real journey.
Right.
And made it more of a personal film. And then because of the locale, it made it a beautiful film on top of it.
Oh, yeah.
I think they handled that really well. And again, you know, spoilers being spoilers, and that we might be going in a little late, or might be jumping a little ahead, but the fact that he has these fantasies, which I can relate to because I have the same fantasies, which I thought was...
Anyone that wears a cardigan has those kind of fantasies.
Like the fantasy he has where he hears the dog barking and he's waiting at the bus stop and he's talking to Patton Oswalt on the phone, and he immediately runs and just jumps off and goes through the window and comes out yelling, stuff like that, like all the time. That's what's constantly going on in my brain.
That was one of my favorites, not just from the visual aspect of it, but the way it was acted and set up.
Yes.
Because you hear the dog barking, and then he just, like, just out of nowhere jumps off this building, and you're like, what the hell?
Right.
So, and then you immediately obviously know it's a fantasy sequence, but you don't understand, what does this have to do with anything? And then he sees her, and you realize, oh, okay.
Well,
you know?
usually when in a movie, when they're going to do a fantasy sequence of some sort, there's some sort of Wayne's World, twiddly-doo, you know, like some kind of way to trigger.
Like set up or something, yeah.
Some sort of, I'm going to let the audience know that we're going to go into a fantasy scenario. In this, they didn't bother with that. You never knew in the first half of the movie what was going to be a fantasy scenario and what was just going to be what was happening. And as they were making the transition from fantasy to reality, you didn't know. And that, and I love that kind of, you're hanging on the precipice with the character where you don't know whether it's real or fantasy until that's revealed to you, you know?
I loved that aspect of it.
That's what I thought was so brilliant on the sequence in the boat when he starts grabbing the guy's face after the shark attack.
Right.
The porpoise.
The porpoise. That's not a porpoise.
But that whole sequence, as ridiculous as that is, the way it was jumping up at him and all that stuff, I love that they actually played that moment out of him grabbing people. It's like, oh, crap, that was real? You know, it's not only him starting to realize it, but it's telling the audience, okay, that happened. You know, at that point, everything from then on happens.
And the really cool thing is,
I love it.
Go ahead, Catherine. I'm sorry.
I love in the middle of the movie, it kind of starts to make you second guess yourself. Mm-hmm. It's like, okay, no, wait a minute, this is a fantasy. No, this is real. Okay.
Right. When he sits down with Patton Oswalt after Patton Oswalt gets him out of airport jail, and Patton Oswalt says to you, as the audience, essentially, saying it to Ben Stiller, but says it to you, hey, how have your fantasies been? And all of a sudden, in your mind, because you're so involved in that movie at that point, in his journey, in your mind, you're like, wait a second, there haven't been any fantasies for like an hour. Like, like that's when it dawns on you, like, and you start thinking back to all the stuff, there haven't been any fantasies. It's all been reality, and he's living his life instead of living in this fantasy world now. Holy hell, that happened. Like, they played that so well.
Well, and you bring up the Patton Oswalt character, I thought that was such a subtle yet brilliant move to bring a character that he has connection, that's the one character he doesn't know.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And he has a connection, and this guy is more obsessed with him because of his strangeness and his daydreams and his lack of profile. It's almost like it went from being his job, I've got to get this guy to finish his profile, to they've almost become friends, to, you know, him now relying, it's the only guy he's got. And, you know, this whole time you kind of wonder, why the hell does this guy keep bothering him? You know, why? This guy's got some stalker issues. Calling him about his eHarmony profile, you know? But it's got such a major part of his journey that the way they bring it together, as ridiculous as it is in real life, it's still, like, subtle brilliance, you know, and let Patton Oswalt be kind of the funny guy on the phone and let Ben Stiller continue being more of a straight man.
Whoa. Yeah, sort of the he's sort of the reality touchstone, what I thought about the eHarmony, when you're representing yourself online, how much of your online presence is the true you, and how much of your online presence is when you're a legend in your own mind?
Right, right.
and I thought that had a really cool parallel to go along with his daydreaming and all of that. It kind of gave it an older story, a bit of a modern touch.
Well,
Lyle was still pointing at her later that all of her profile was true.
Right.
Three-legged dog and the two-legged kid. And
if you are a student of, and I'm going to get a little pretentious here, if you are a student of the Joseph Campbell School of Storytelling, you know, and you're looking at a three-act play, which is essentially what this movie was, the Patton Oswalt character really, and it took me a while to get this because I was thinking about where it happened, but the Patton Oswalt character was really the oracle. The Patton Oswalt character is what set him on his journey. You can say it was Sean Penn, or you can say it was Adam Scott, who has, by the way, the best beard I've ever seen on film. Period.
That beard was ridiculous.
That was an amazing beard. That was the worst horrific atrocity that I've ever seen.
I was waiting for them to do something. I was like, they've got to be setting this beard up for a purpose. And he's going to have an imagination moment, and he's going to rip that beard off of his face.
I just think it
never came, and I'm like, really? That was just your choice to be a good beard?
I just don't know. I think it was there for the whole reason that we're all saying this. It was there to make you uncomfortable.
Right.
You know, as the viewer, you're watching it going, and you're kind of squirming. You're like looking at this beard like, it's a little pervy and weird and commanding. Like, I'm off-put by this beard this guy has. But Patton Oswalt's character really sets him on his journey. He goes to the Oracle. The Oracle says, you need to go on a... literally says, you need to go on a journey. Where have you been? You've been nowhere.
Be more interesting.
Right.
Let me just say, in relation... because of his character being such a... It's really a small part, because he's not in the movie that much. But uh-huh. He's in it very important. But let me just say, there had to be something magical related to him, because either that or... Walter Mitty has the best cell phone service I have ever seen.
I'm telling you. Yes,
he's in the Himalayas or whatever getting phone calls. He's in Iceland getting phone calls. And they're clear. They're perfect.
I go through the lobby at the bank and I get cut off my cell service.
I can't wait at my kid's school without having a losing signal.
No, but, you know, you're absolutely right.
Go ahead.
It's his unbroken connection to that. Because who else does he call outside of Patton Oswalt? He talks to Patton Oswalt and he talks to what's her name, and those are the two people he really talks to.
And he only calls her, I think, once, right?
Yeah, when he has the clue about the boat name.
While he's in Iceland,
right?
Yeah, which is hilarious to me on that moment, because she goes, you know I told you Greenland, right?
She's like, nothing's going to be good enough for her.
You know, and I think it's
possible... Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Do you think it's possible that when he's on top of the mountain and he has the cell phone call, that's a daydream?
No, I think all of those conversations were actually occurring, because I think those were part of the journey of him growing, because he felt more comfortable talking to her, and he felt more... Because as you notice, especially with the conversations with Patton Oswalt, the conversations were very uncomfortable from his side from the beginning. Then it got to where he just talked to him, like, you know, as he grew through the journey, both conversations he had with the people became comfortable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So it went from the first ones to be like, to, look, I'm really busy. I'm in the middle of doing this. I ain't got time to talk, you know? and running into street signs.
Ben Stiller is an amazing actor. And this is proof of that the guy can actually act and not just act as a comedian. You know, you can give him a good script. He can act that script, because what we saw in that 2 hours and 9 minutes was the evolution of self-confidence over that journey that he went on. And he portrayed it so well and so subtly that by the end you don't even really recognize it until he's sitting in the airport. Like, so you went through Burma or something, and he's like, yeah, that's why I went through Yemen. Like, you know, it's just like, I have all the confidence in the world to tell you where I've been.
Yeah, and they only wanted his flute back. That's all he gave a shit about.
Right.
He's like, can I just get my flute? Yeah, he's handcuffed. And he's like, But, you know, I think, you know, as great an actor as he is, I think this film even showcases more the fact that he directed it as well.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's always gotten credit for being a good director. You know, his film, you know, he puts out stuff, you know, like the Zoolanders and the cable guys that kind of get more of the cult following, and then you have the Tropic Thunders, and what is it, the Reality Bites.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, but a film like this, I think, is really showcases that he has that ability as a director to not only be able to act and direct at the same time, which is, I heard him in an interview recently that he hates doing because it's so much work, but also being able to deliver a big film, because even as big as Tropic Thunder is, this to me was a bigger film because it had the over-the-top effects. It had all the emotion. Mm-hmm. It had the visuals. It had everything it needed to make, for all intents and purposes, a perfect film.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, that's why I wanted to see it in the theater, is because of all the landscapes and things that it promised. I wanted to see this on the big screen.
Yeah. Well, and what I was saying a while ago, real fast, before we get too far away from that,
sure.
Kristen Wiig, I thought, I mean, I love her anyway. She's so awkwardly cute and strange and everything. But I thought the way she played the part is, because she's just as uncomfortably awkward as he is.
Mm-hmm.
She's just kind of figured out life. But she's still strange. So they kind of played off each other well, because even when he's awkward talking to her, he doesn't seem any more awkward. I keep waiting for her to say something just as stupid or to daydream like him.
Uh-huh.
But then she's like, okay, well, I'm going to leave, you know, because she still seems, you know, I'm assuming it's like her kid situation has kind of grounded her, even though she's still kind of socially awkward.
Right. She's definitely grounded. And I think that that's one of the reasons he's attracted to her, is because she is grounded. And
right. It made it that idea of her being someone that he could potentially get more believable.
Right.
As opposed to, you know, half the movies like this, they give some girl that's, you know, they put in like a Brooke Shields from 1985.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's this gorgeous, she falls for him because he's the, you know, he's got the heart of gold. You know, where here, it's this guy he's a normal-looking guy, he's nothing wrong with him, he doesn't have
confidence. He's average, yeah.
Yeah, he doesn't have confidence in himself or how to live.
I think the coolest part in the movie was not any of the location shots. I mean, those were cool. Not any of the imaginary sequences, but the one scene where he's in the park, the skate park, and she's on the phone.
Yes.
And he's teaching the kid how to like kickflip and stuff. And it's not a, you know, it's not him being a, you know, it's not an imaginary thing. That's where his confidence is, and you can see it in that scene. And every time she looks over, he's, you know, standing on the skateboard. But every time she turns away, he's in the middle of doing a flip or an ollie or something.
The reason I think that works so well is they could have easily fumbled it, done the stereotypical thing that he gets frustrated because she didn't notice.
Right.
But he played it off to where, you know, he's clearly wanting her to see him do this amazing stuff. She doesn't, and he just kind of lets it go. You know, almost like, well, that's just normal for me. Nobody ever knows. You know, and I think if they had started making him frustrated from that, then it would have taken the normality of him away.
Yeah, and he's also, I think, kind of channeling a point in his life when he was truly, truly happy and secure and felt different than he had to, you know, he explains as a character how, you know, overnight he had to enter the grown-up world and never go back.
Well, I'm glad that just very subtly explained, you know, how he went from the Mohawk skateboard person to this guy that he is now. You know, because I started thinking that when they started showing the pictures at the beginning, and they're never telling us anything, and I'm like, okay, well, where in your life did things go wrong? You know,
right.
What made you this guy? You know, and it was so subtle, it was Papa John's.
And I love the fact that Papa John's kept making reappearances throughout the movie.
You know, what's funny is that his mom turned it into, because, you know, he never realized, okay, well, the correlation of the name Dad and where he was working, until she goes, you got that job because Papa John's reminded you of your father. He goes, well, not, it didn't then, you know?
Yeah, no. Thanks, Mom.
Now he's bummed out about it, but that was the foreshadowing for him to find Papa John's there and then tell her and come to the realization, which was even funnier when she's like, she's more obsessed that there's a Papa John's in Iceland.
Right.
Really his story.
Well, I loved his mom's character because this was so well acted, because she did came across as somebody who has lived with a person all of his life, and he just and takes for granted that he, mentally he just leaves.
Right.
Well, and she, yeah, and she, and you never really knew until the end of the movie if she was crazy or not.
Right.
You know, one minute she seemed a little off, next minute she just seems like, you know, everyone's average mom. And I my only issue that I had, I mean, there was two points and they were kind of in the same sequence. When she starts talking about meeting Sean Penn's character, I think that was played down a little too much, because for him to have worked with him that long and have never met him, which he had stated earlier in the film that we've never met, we talk, but we've never met in person.
Right.
For him to not be more shocked that he was in there visiting his mother, to me was just like, I would have been like, what, you know, but he was very like, oh, you talked to him? You know, it was kind of that aspect. But then that same sequence, the whole wallet situation, which they could have just had him throw it away, and then I keep everything, and it would have worked fine. But if you watch her while she's cooking, she looks at the trash can when he throws it away.
Right.
Right.
So she sees what he throws away, so you know she's going to pick it up.
Right.
You know, but I think that little subtle, if you don't pay attention, you never see that, but it was a nice little foreshadowing again, saying, you know, to connection to her hoarding of his stuff, of his nonsense. Yeah.
I think that the picture in the wallet was a little bit of a softball, though.
It was. It was. I saw that coming. Yeah.
Right, right.
I dug it just from the standpoint because I knew the wallet was going to be more than what they did.
Right.
The reason it worked for me was because when he first tells him he put the picture in the wallet, I'm like, oh, so that's such a cop out, you know.
Right.
That's such an easy way out. But when he says, that's not funny, and he goes, yeah, maybe that wasn't all that good of a joke. I didn't really think that. It's showing the absurdity of what he did. Like anybody would have ever thought to look in that wallet.
Right.
For something that important, you know, he's like, oh.
Well,
and what is he almost turns into kind of a Spicoli there for a second.
That speaks to the Sean Penn character, though, that he's so far removed from normal society, you know, that he just goes out into the wild and takes his pictures and nobody can ever find him, and he sends actual telegrams, which I thought was so cool.
It was hilarious when he's like, this is the telegram from that old man, and then they got that panorama shot of the old man standing in the back, just kind of waves his arm and keeps walking.
That's right. You know, that he's so far removed, he's almost the polar opposite of Walter Mitty.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, it's two sides to the same coin, where Walter Mitty, and that's the whole thing, is Walter Mitty is the, I wear a short-sleeved dress shirt and a tie, and I develop this film, where Sean Penn's character is, you know, I wear a lot of hemp necklaces, and I take the pictures. So, that's interesting to me.
See, and I thought Sean Penn's character, you know, I knew he was obviously an important part of the story. But his character was like, that little bit you finally get with him close to the end was just such a phenomenal sequence between the two, which was a sequence I would have never thought you would get between Sean Penn and Ben Stiller.
Right.
Which, the exchange of dialogue, because it was like, it was, you know, literally like two guys that have known each other for years talking. And then, but he's also, you know, like you're saying, so removed. Even after he realizes, okay, I did a stupid thing by putting it in the thing and I threw it away, and he's like, well, my feelings are hurt. He's not concerned that his picture will never be seen. He's now upset that he threw his wallet away, and that he's still not that shocked that he found him.
I thought it was perfect, and there's so many stages in the process where he's looking for Sean Penn. Like, you have the conversation where his mom told him about Sean coming by, and he was glazed over, and he didn't hear a word she said. And when he drops the radio parts in the ocean, and the people on the boat are, you know, it's a bummer, but no one's yelling at him or chewing him out.
Right.
It's all these moments where people could just kind of explode in anger because something just really nasty just happened. They don't. They just kind of, it's like, you know, nothing can be done. You know, why get angry?
Right.
The reason I think that works so much better, because all the people that accepted him and didn't treat him like crap, that weren't his family or the girl,
were
foreign people. So it was like that American culture difference. He goes home, you know, the boss guy's a jerk, people work. He goes to these foreign countries and they're like, welcome.
Yeah.
You know, and even the guy that's trying to beat him up, the drunk guy at the karaoke bar, beats him up, and once he recognizes his thumb, they're suddenly like their best friends. God, you're a scrappy one.
you know what?
That's a great observation. I didn't notice that.
Yeah, no. But you know what? It just dawned on me. The movie is almost like Fight Club, because it's it's ego searching for id. It's all this control searching for his almost hedonistic, you know, within certain constraints, side of himself that is being portrayed by Sean Penn, and they never meet. They've never met before, you know. So there's two sides to this coin. There's this adventurous guy, and together they formed this one person that provided Time Magazine with all these this photos and this legend of a man, but they couldn't have done it individually. They had to do it together.
Here's the big issue I have with the photo. While I think the photo was epic, because I knew it was going to probably be of him or his mom or something like that.
Right.
There's a fundamental problem here with them firing him, and then the guy looking at that photo and going, oh, hell no. He would not have put that guy's picture on the cover of Life.
Well, especially after he dressed him down in front of the table full of people.
Which was a little more that bummed me out a bit, because I was really hoping he would do it a little bit more, you know, make it a little more. It had punch to it, but I was really hoping he would put a little more to it. Not necessarily violent or, you know, while that would have been great, but, you know, had a little more, you know, it's such a buildup of this guy antagonizing and treating him like crap, and he's finally got his moment to do something, and he kind of more calmly attacks him, which is fine. Yeah. But he would have taken some of the jabs besides the one, like calling him Gandalf like he had thought about, and different moments, grasping those moments that he's always patting. You know, I wasn't expecting to run in there and choke him with Stretch Armstrong. I would have liked to see that, because that's an amazing idea of any sequence I've ever seen.
I think that was one of the most wonderful fight sequences I've ever seen in a movie. Hands down.
All for a Stretch Armstrong.
But I think the point is, with that down-dressing that he gave Adam Scott's character, was that he has grown so much.
Right.
By the time he walks in and throws that negative down on the table, that he just looks at Adam Scott, and whatever is inside of him dissolves, because he feels sorry for him. You know, it's like you're a petulant child at this point that has taken this thing and treated it as if it was your toy, which, again, he's stealing the toy. He steals, you know, he's taking from people. He's a bully. He takes from people.
Right.
And you know, just him walking in and just kind of shaking his head, Ben Stiller, and just looking at him in the eye, you know, and telling him to put it on his next, you know, put it on a plaque on the wall as his next job, was just his way of saying, you know, wake up, man. Like, this isn't this life you lead is pathetic, and I'm willing to tell you that. I'm scared of you.
He should have had his beard at that moment. If he was going to do all that, he should have found it. Because I was, in my mind, I'm reciting as he's talking, and I'm saying, and he's saying it, and I'm saying, at the end of it, he's going to end it, and he's going to call him Gandalf. And he didn't, and I was pissed. I was like, really? The one thing I've asked for in this entire movie, and you don't give it to me.
That would have been petty, though. You know, like, at that point, he had kind of achieved a zen-like state. You know, if it would have been an hour earlier, yeah, he would have done it.
And the other problem I have is Ben Stiller should have kept his beard that he had in the second half of the film.
Right, I agree with that.
Patton Oswalt came to get him from the airport, he looked like a badass. He goes to pick up his severance packet. Even when he goes to deliver the picture, he looks like a badass. Goes to pick up his severance packet, and he's a guy from the beginning of the movie again.
But I thought that was kind of symbolic. He was the exact same on the outside, but totally changed on the inside.
Right, if you could run those two sequences side by side, you could see the change in self-esteem and self-respect in the acting of the character. You didn't need the beard and the hemp necklaces.
No, but he would look so much better, and she would have melted in his arms immediately. There would have been enough all this nonsense and talking. She would have said, oh, God, and it would have just been over.
He did look good with that beard, though. I'll give you that.
Oh, my goodness. One of my only big issues with the whole film that I think was a missed opportunity, but I think it could have easily gone horribly wrong, is some of the humor aspect. I think they could have pushed a little bit to make some more entertainment early on when they were clearly, like, you know, when they had the Benjamin Button kind of sequence, which was really funny.
That was so funny.
That was creepy.
It was creepy, hilarious, but that moment showcased and said, okay, there's some really funny stuff to be had with these imagination sequences. Yeah. They're not just fantastical. And then they kind of quickly give it to you and take it away from you, just like they did with the imaginary sequences, and then focus on just the emotional journey. And I think they could have, you know, with the length of time the movie run, I think they could have had a few more moments that made a little more humor, lightheartedness for the journey. that it didn't hurt the film. No, it wasn't anything that I thought made the film bad. I just think there were so many moments there that could have been a lot more humorous and even added another depth of the film to make it even that much better.
Yeah, I kind of almost got the impression that there may have been a few fantasy sequences that were shot that didn't make the film.
Yeah, I bet there are.
Well, if you look at the posters they released, there's one where he's standing on the moon. They have one where he's standing on surfing a dolphin.
Oh, really?
You know, I don't know if any of those were ever in the film, but those are on some of the posters.
Okay.
So
well, that's quite
maybe
possible.
Maybe there's deleted fantasy sequences we'll get on the Blu-ray and DVD coming soon.
Well, maybe they thought that it was, you know, it slowed the film down, but yeah, but yeah, I agree. I would have enjoyed seeing just a few more, and I'm sure you guys feel the same way when I say I cried at the end of that film. After seeing the cover photo, I was like, okay, it's tear time. And
I can say I did not cry, but I am a heartless bastard, so I haven't cried at anything in related to TV or film since Arnold was almost molested by the Maytag man.
Oh.
And
by Mr. What was his name in WKRP? I can't remember.
It was the bicycle repair guy. I don't remember now.
It's a very special episode of
that. And he left Dudley there doing the jungle poses behind the plant without his shirt on.
What's wrong with you, Bobby? What is wrong with you?
That one and the one where Arnold takes the knife to school in his zipper bag because of Willis getting beat up. Those are very emotional times.
Did you cry when Plucky Brewster got stuck in the refrigerator?
With Arnold.
me and Arnold had a lot of in common because we're both very short people. I just happened to grow out of it. Boom.
How far did you grow out of it, Bobby?
Not very.
Right.
And yes, I was quite upset when Plucky Brewster got stuck. And it was Cherry that got stuck in
the fridge. Got stuck in the fridge. Yeah, that's right.
Fridge, yes.
Well, I thought that was such an incredible photo to have as the cover, and maybe it's because I am of that generation where I hate to see the printed world end. I know it's time for it to go.
No, it's
but,
not.
But I hate to see it go.
Well, I like that aspect, especially I was so glad they kept used the magazine Life, because even the title of the magazine is a metaphor for what he's trying to find, which is a life, you know.
Right.
He has none, and that book, that magazine was, you know, kind of encompassed everything, and the motto and everything was all about what his journey was going to be. It also is that pointing out that fact that we're losing that aspect, just like he was losing, you know, his dad and didn't have any life to grasp onto and was having to kind of find something to move forward. So him losing the job, the paper going away, is now him having to find something new to go with.
But it was so sweet at the very end where he grabs her hand walking down the street. He's like, oh, my goodness.
That was a little bit inappropriate.
Yes, it was perfect.
It was inappropriate because you have boundaries, and she has not said that it was okay. But right
now, are you kidding? She's been saying it's okay since they met.
Right.
No, she agreed to go to the weird church for the grease.
That is the best sentence I've ever heard.
Yes. But when he said that, I did laugh out loud because, you know, when he's like, he goes, she's performing as Rizzo in Grease, not Broadway, some weird little church.
Yeah.
And I'm like, wow, I've been to those productions.
Another thing that I loved about his fantasies is when it involves her, it's all about her noticing him and thinking he's so wonderful. It's not the what we would call standard issue male fantasy.
Right. No, he just didn't get to see those. I'm sure he had those on that trip at some point. He was alone. Speaking of which, I have to ask this. It's not really in relation to the fantasy. That early on, I'm glad the cake played a little more part in the bigger picture of the story, because I was a little bothered early on because I thought that cake had tomatoes on it.
The Clementine cake.
Yeah, he's carrying it around at the beginning when his sister brings it to him. And I'm like, what the hell kind of cake is? Why is there tomatoes on it? And I became obsessed with looking at that cake as he carried it everywhere he went there for a while and was really bothered that there was tomatoes on that cake. And I'm like, that is the best cake I've ever seen.
You know what I thought the fate of that cake was going to be when he first got it? He went over to the break table and set it down, and I thought he was going
to he was going to eat it, didn't he? I thought the same thing. I was watching. He was going to go in there, open the fridge. He was going to get some, or get his coffee or whatever. He was going to turn around, and that fat guy was going to be eating his cake. And it was another slap in his face.
Be nothing but a plate of crumbs, because that's our office. You know, it's like
I thought the same thing when that guy walked up behind him. I was like, that cake is gone. Then he didn't eat it, and I'm like, really? Come on, guy. You know you wanted some of that tomato cake.
My favorite part of that entire sequence was when Adam Scott calls him Major Tom, because in my brain, that's where exactly what happened in the movie is what happened in my brain. I'm like, oh, this jackass doesn't even know what that song's about. Like, why is he calling him Major? God, I hate him so much, this pretentious turd. I hate him so, this mouth-breathing Philistine drives me crazy.
That sequence, as much as I love it, my favorite part is the guy next to him who was like, he goes, yeah, I threw a printer cartridge at one of him. Oh, what did he do? I don't know. I missed.
Yeah, the guy with the real douchey hair. The guy with the super douchey.
Did you notice all the management people had beards?
Right.
Every one of them in the sequence, when they're throwing stuff at him, and then when they're trying to tell the story to the employees about what's happening, all of them have beards. The other two guys have real beards. He has the douchey beard, but
and the hair that coif. Oh my god!
It was brilliant.
It was awesome.
It was 80s workplace movie. I was waiting for Michael J. Fox to come walking out from somewhere at some point during any of those sequences.
You mean come shaking in?
Oh, it's not Paranormal Activity.
Oh, too soon.
It's okay because he has a TV show and he's mocking himself now. So now we all can.
I don't think he's mocking himself. I think that's a strong adjective.
Okay, if you want to refer to it as embracing, that's fine. Okay.
Making it your own.
That's right.
When you have a sequence in the show and he's walking around and he's carrying, like, serving bread to people, and he throws one in the guy's laps and he goes, sorry, Parkinson's, I think he's mocking himself.
That's true. He might be mocking himself at that point.
Well. Good for him. Make it your own.
That's right.
Exactly.
Oh, well.
I have to say one thing. The only sequence I thought was out of place, even though it was entertaining, was that x-ray sequence.
Yes.
It seemed forced. To me, I wasn't as... It was funny to watch, but it took me out of the film and took it somewhere else for a second. Like it was like a spoof.
Yeah. It did seem out of place. Now, the one thing that it did for me is it did, without wasting too much time or words, make it clear that he was in airport security.
Right.
And I didn't understand why he was trying to smuggle that. It's not like he could have just put that in his bag and they would have looked at it and thought it was a flute and he would have moved on. I don't know. There was no reason to smuggle a flute.
That's true. There was no reason to smuggle a flute.
Now, if he was smuggling some of his cake back, then I could see that because, you know, it's food and they'll check it and it's whatever, but
he had to give that to the warlords to get through.
Unless there's some weird flute law in America that I wasn't aware of. Which I did give up my days as a master flutesman quite some time ago, so I don't know how things are these days.
You gave them up so long ago that you forgot it was called a flautist. You just...
Exactly.
I want to call you the Master Flutesman from now on.
And I'll accept it, Cardigan.
Oh, awesome. Cardigan and the Flutesman. Only on AMC.
We'll be detectives.
Oh.
Well,
solving the crimes that no one knew were there.
Solving the crimes. Sorry, Catherine, what were you saying?
Oh, quite
all right. No, brother, you show, sorry.
Bobby and I just developed an entire 3-season TV show called Cardigan and the Flutesman, or the Flutesman and Cardigan.
Call CBS, they're kind of wanty right now.
Right.
Sorry, Paul.
We're going to be on what was the Bravo Network? What did they become?
I don't know. I didn't watch that network, Eric Cardigan.
I forget. Hey, Flutesman, why don't you go back to whatever Flutesman does?
Spend a lot of time on PBS.
Is that right?
Well, let's go ahead and get toward wrapping up so you guys can grow that acorn into a mighty oak.
That's right.
And give us how many stars you'd give it and whether or not you'd recommend it, although I have a pretty good idea of what you'd say. Andy, why don't you get us started?
I think it's... How many stars am I allowed?
You're 1 to 5.
7 billion.
1 to 5. All right, Carl Sagan. 1 to 5. I give it 4 stars. Okay. And I've already recommended it to everyone that I've spoken to, so I'm going to firmly recommend it. It gets a huge thumbs up from Cardigan.
Awesome. Awesome. Bobby, what do you say?
The Flutesman speaketh the same. No, I really dug it. I would actually probably give it a 4.5 to 5, just because it delivered so much more than I really expected it to. I thought it was going to be a great movie. I thought, you know, we have all these fantastical, fun little moments and things like that. But I really got more out of it by the end of it. And I really loved it. And I highly recommend it to people. I just hope people will go in with that open mind and not the perception that they're going to get a fantastical comedy, and just let the movie happen in front of you, because it'll be a much better experience.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Right. I agree. I would give it 4.5 as well. I loved it. It made me happy. It was a fun movie-going experience, and I would recommend it really to anybody. It is all ages friendly. I can't think of anything about it that would be inappropriate for any age. So
the three-legged dog,
which is nice these days. They didn't throw that one scene in there that makes it uncomfortable for anybody. So.
Right.
I loved it. I would recommend it. And like I said, 4.5 stars.
The three-legged dog might freak some people out.
Well.
And they got, and Andrew Scott's beard.
Adam Scott's that beard. Is the creepiest thing.
Adam Scott's beard and the three-legged dog really might have come from the same thing. They look similar.
It's well, the representation.
That sounds like two episode titles from The Cardigan and the
The Flutesman and the Cardigan rolls off the tongue. I'll give Bobby top billing. The Flutesman and the Cardigan.
The Mystery of the Bearded Three-Legged Dog.
That's right.
All of a sudden, it's an episode of McMillan and Wife.
Right. It's somewhere between Kolchak Night Stalker and McMillan and Wife now.
with some sprinkles of Remington Steel.
That's right.
Let me tell you about some sprinkles of Remington Steel.
I would prefer you didn't.
Back in my day.
Keep your sprinkles to yourself, weirdo.
Oh, my gosh. Fellas, thank you so much, as always. I had a great time. And thanks, everybody, for tuning in to What'd You Think.
Thank you so much, Catherine, for having me.
Oh, Andy, you want to plug your stuff real quick?
Oh, yes, I thought we were going to have to get away from that.
I was prepared not to plug my stuff.
Okay, well, we can always leave it out.
I'm prepared to plug your stuff.
Oh, Bobby.
Man cometh.
The Flutesman cometh. You can go over the same place you found this show, JediCole.com, at the Jedi Cole universe. You can find Hey Kids Comics, which is the Jedi Cole and I's, and occasionally Bobby's and occasionally Catherine's, hour-long comic book podcast released weekly on Wednesdays. Check us out over there. That's all the plugs I have. I just sit alone in a room and wait for somebody to tell me to podcast, and then I do it. That's
happy and sad all at the same time.
That's what I said. I really relate to this movie. Cause that's...
You clearly didn't learn anything from the movie, though.
You know what's funny, though? I'll tell you what I did after I went and saw the movie, and this is sad and funny at the same time.
You went to Papa John's?
Yeah, guide?
I got in my car and just drove. I drove for 3 hours. I just got in my car, and I'm like, I'm going to go find adventure in Ohio. And you know what I found?
A QT, I hope, because you're about out of gas.
I found that Neil Armstrong Air and Space Museum that I didn't know existed.
Sweet!
Yeah, they had all these wonderful Christmas lights up, and I just saw
Did
it off
you
the...
Go to it?
Yeah, well, it was like 11 o'clock at night. I went up to it.
And you didn't have an adventure yet, sir.
I wandered around in the Christmas lights for a good long time.
Now you're just doing criminal activity.
And then I got back in my car and I drove home and felt slightly fulfilled. So I had a not-so-secret life of the cardigan that night.
Well, Bobby, I know you are going to be at Space City Con this coming weekend, and where else are you going to pop up?
Well, I pop up when Andrew's around.
Gross, but
I do regular reviews on theexaminer.com. You can just look up my name, Bobby Blakey, not Blakely, even though everybody calls me that. And then still being held hostage starting in 2014, doing You Are Here cartoons for Cole over the Jedi Cole Universe, as well as co-hosting this show with the lovely Catherine.
Aww.
And the other guests we have. And I do other things too, but most people don't care. So mostly just find me on the Jedi Cole Universe, helping out with whatever the Cole forces me to do.
There you go.
Sweet. Sweet. And as always, if you're currently stalking us, we'll all be at AllCon this coming March in Addison.
AllCon?
AllCon? Represent? You might get a special appearance by the flutesman and the cardigan at AllCon this year.
It is a gathering of heroes.
It is.
Oh, Bobby.
It's on.
I foresee the flutesman and cardigan teaching the placeholder some manners.
Oh, I like this idea. I like the smackdown.
And just so everyone knows, while we were doing this podcast, I already submitted the copyright. So nobody's trying to steal our brilliant idea.
We already mailed it to ourselves.
That's right. Are you kidding? I've gone on to T-Fury and submitted some
preliminary arts.
That's right.
I've already got three treatments written up, all right?
The downside of this is I got to buy a damn flute now.
And you know what the upside is? I don't need to buy any cardigans. I have all of them, so.
Yeah, you can't get in and out of them, so we don't know which one you're going to wear.
That's the running gag, Bobby, is that, you know, I'm always stuck in my cardigan.
And I'm always losing my flute.
What'll happen next?
With that, we say goodnight.
And on that note, goodnight, everybody.
Goodnight, everybody.